Hello there, and welcome to the Comic Book Tesseract, the weekly comics netcast that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. I'm Justin Chalupka. Every week, we review and preview the world of comics, along with other facets of geek chic culture. With me this week is my good friend, Mr. Jason Poliev. Jason, how you doing this week, man?
I am doing well. It's been a great week, Justin. How are you?
I am doing very good. My comics stack has shrunk this week, so my wallet was saved the agonizing horror of expensive books. But some of the good books this week. We had a lot of good, great stories come out this week. A lot of follow-ups, actually, as this is the month of that. But to start it off, I want to talk about Dungeons & Dragons number 12. Dungeons & Dragons has been put out by IDW for, obviously, a full year now. And they've gone through, actually, probably close to about three story arcs, which is interesting for a book that's only been out this long. But the arcs that they've done have been really very entertaining, very interesting. If you're not a player of Dungeons & Dragons, this is still a comic worth picking up, especially if you like the fantasy genre, because the character interaction in this book is both entertaining, it's interesting, and it is hilarious. There's a couple characters that are there for the slapstick value, and they pull it off to a T. I truly wish that the gaming groups I played in were half as witty as these characters are, because it would have made it just so much that much more entertaining. So like I said, even if you're not a D&D player, I'm sorry, say that again?
It's all about who you play with.
It is, because D&D, just because I'm a player, I know Jason's a player as well. If you don't play D&D and you don't understand this, D&D is all about the group. It's all about not the game itself, but the people that you're with and just enjoying time with them, which is what this podcast is about too. It's about us spending time and sharing with all of you guys out there. We're glad that you're here. Won't you be our neighbors? Anyways,
thank you, Mr. Rogers.
Moving on. Another great book that came out this week is Samurai Blood. This is number 5 of 6 of this short-run series. Samurai Blood tells the story of a family in Japan who was slaughtered by a rival family, and this is in the feudal era, the Edo period, and the subsequent rise to revenge of the surviving members of that family. It's been very interesting. It delves a lot into the idea of Bushido, of the warrior code of the samurai, and how these three surviving members, of whom there is the lordly son, the servant son, who is the one who's attempting to be samurai, and a daughter, and how each of these three are treated differently in the Japanese society of that time. It's, if you are a fan of Japanese culture or of that historical period in Japan, it's a must read. It's not particularly strict to fact. It's not, you know, really, really hardcore into, you know, being anachronistic, but it's enough that it keeps it entertaining. And if you don't know a whole lot about it but want to learn more, it gives you enough good information to want to make you want to go out and find out more about that period, which is a very interesting period of time in history. Anyways, those were the books that I read from the independent publishers for this week. Paul, you had quite a few books from the more major indie publishers this week that you read. What did you pick up?
Well, first publisher that I picked up from was IDW, and I picked up the G.I. Joe Snake Eyes Civil War tie-in that Chuck Dixon and Casey Malone wrote. I really enjoyed this book. Snake Eyes and Duke go out to retrieve a doctor who's created the next plague and has set it loose on Africa. Duke gets to show Snake Eyes an old trick or two, which Snake Eyes, being a ninja and being the badass that they've always presented him to be, is kind of fun to see somebody else getting to show him a trick or two. And, of course, badassery ensues. This is a great crossover. One of the things I love about, I think, a well-done crossover is when you're able to read each individual title and you understand what's going on in that title. You don't have to pick up other books outside the title to understand what's going on. And yet there are glimpses, there are hints, and there are relevant facts from other books that are going on. So you get to see what is going on around you in this world, but it stays primarily told in the one book that you're reading. So, if you do just want to buy that one title, you can. Now, the other thing that was a nice treat is there's a appearance at the end of this book by Quinn, the Inuit. Now, for people that have been reading G.I. Joe since Larry Hama was writing the Marvel run, they'll remember back at the very beginning of the Marvel run, there was a character, Quinn, who was set as an equal to Snake Eyes, and perhaps even a better. So that shows the level of badassery. It's just a nice little throwback to see Quinn pop up at the end of this book. And it'll be interesting to see what Dixon does with him, because he was only in the very beginning, one or two issues of the original Marvel run. And speaking of the Marvel run, Larry Hama with S.L. Gallant is continuing the run that he started with Marvel in G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, issue 171. IDW started this series picking up where the Marvel series left off. So Ham is getting to tell the stories that he's always wanted to tell, that he was going to tell with the Marvel, but couldn't. And one of the things that you get to really see in this is you get to see Larry is kind of glad he doesn't have to keep the toys in mind when writing this book. He's got all the characters that were introduced to the toy line, but he doesn't have to keep them alive so they can produce new toys. It's not tied into the toy line like the Marvel run was. And he shows that by killing off some people. And I suspect we'll be seeing more of that. The one thing that kind of irked me about this book, and it was a strong book, and it continues to be the quality that Hammer's written, but the one thing that irked me is Larry seems to be trying to point out just how much military jargon he knows. Instead of saying, hey, pass me that gun, pass me the 7.62 millimeter, full-on hardball ammunition. It's just got had to pull in too much jargon, I think. And it kind of pulled me back from the story. It doesn't sound like natural dialogue for the characters. That's my one knock on it. Otherwise, it was a solid book, and I really enjoyed it. Now, jumping away from IDW, we go over to Image Comics, where I read Near Death. And this was issue number 2. Jay Farber and Simone Guglielmini, and I'm sure I butchered Simone's last name, but they put together a solid book, but it wasn't very, it was rather bland. It didn't have a whole lot of flavor. The story is about an assassin who gains a conscience. He has a near-death experience and decides he can't kill people anymore. So what he has to do to earn his salvation is protect people from being killed, and while doing that, not kill anybody else. So the second story, it was kind of a monster of the week story, but it didn't really have anything you haven't seen elsewhere. You've seen this story probably done much the same way on television, in other comics, in short stories. Just didn't bring anything new to the table in the telling of this story. Now, I'm going to give it to issue 3. I'm going to read that, see if it starts to bring something new, something that the character hasn't had before. And hopefully they'll find a way to start making this its own story, even if it's similar. I realize we've heard it all before. We've told all the stories. But usually there's something, the character traits, their personality, the wit, something that makes it stand out from other previous versions. So hopefully, we'll start to see that in issue 3. And lastly, I read The Strange Tale of Luther Strode, issue number 1, by Justin Jordan and Trad Moore. This book I picked up and kind of flipped through it at the store and said, I'll give it a shot, I'll see. I was looking for something different and didn't expect much of it. I saw there was a lot of gore in this and expected it to be nothing but mindless violence and not have much of a story, not much of a plot. I was surprised. I liked this book a lot more than I thought I would. And, yes, there is a lot of violence. There is definitely gore, and it is designed to be gory and shocking. And the story isn't you know, that unique of a story. It's the nerdy kid who's tired of getting bullied by the bigger, stronger kids. He wants a girlfriend. Yeah. Whether you're Peter Parker, Bruce Banner, you know, Steve Rogers, that type of a story has already been told in comics, but they did a wonderful, unique way of telling it. Somewhere in this world, there is a cult or some sort of secret society that goes after the people that gain the strange talents like Luther did. And the other thing that was really neat is they had a great way of showing the powers, of showing what Luthor was sensing or seeing that allowed him to do what he was going to do next. You know, kind of, there was a precognition. There was kind of an X-ray vision where he got to see the muscle and bone structure of the people in front of him to know how to do the most damage. So, you know, there were definitely unique individual, you know, ways of displaying and showing what was going on, and, you know, adding in that difference, that society really leaves you wondering where this is going to go. So I really enjoyed this book. And again, you know, it was a story that you've probably heard before, the nerd wanting to get superpowers to take revenge and get the girl, but they did it in a unique way that I really enjoyed. So, yeah. Justin, I understand you picked up Arkham City this week.
Oh, my, how did I? Oh, it...
So the wife hasn't seen you. You've been locked in the room playing the game?
Oh, no. She saw me. It was 5 in the morning, but she saw me. Let me caveat this with, I loved Arkham Asylum. I thought it was a fantastic game. It's been given accolades. I believe it was the best game of the year it came out, which I think was 2008, if I remember correctly. And Arkham City, if you loved Arkham Asylum, you will love Arkham City. If you liked Arkham Asylum, you'll love Arkham City. If you didn't like Arkham Asylum, I don't know who you are. Because what Arkham City does is it gives you everything that Arkham Asylum was. I mean, mechanically, as far as gameplay is concerned, it's the same game. It hasn't changed anything, and it picks up right where you left off as far as combat maneuvers, gadgets, all the fun toys, and it doesn't take them away. A lot of games like God of War and things like that will take away those toys and make you go and earn them again. In this case, you start right where you left off and get even more great things to play with. So, just for that alone, I mean, I'm not going to get into that. But the other thing they changed with this game is that instead of having the more sort of linear task-to-task type of storyline that Arkham Asylum had, where you had the Riddler quiz stuff and you did a lot of backtracking, kind of Metroid style, in Arkham City, they've opened it up to be a bit more sandbox. The size of Arkham City is honestly, I think, about the same size that Arkham Manor was, or the Arkham Asylum was from the previous game, as far as overall geography. But there's more stuff going on in this world. So you can be cruising along, going to whatever your next mission point is, and come across 3 or 4 little mini side quests along the way that you can take care of, you know, kind of as you're on the way there, which, I have to say, as a detriment to the game, can be distracting. You know, you feel bad because you have to hurry to rush to go fight Killer Croc or whatever it is, and on the way there, you're ignoring the political prisoners that are getting shanked beneath you because, hey, you got something you got to do. You don't have time for those little peons. The other big criticism from the game, what was that?
It's just the... Yeah, that's the type of decision Batman has to make. Does he go after the villain? Does he help the person that's off in the side? Does he help, you know, are they innocent victims? Are they innocent bystanders? Are they people that deserve what's going to befall them because of where they are? Yeah. Batman's got to make those decisions. Now you do too.
Which is very true. I can't detract from that at all. But I would say it does make it distracting, if nothing else. Just strictly as a game value. The other thing that people have criticized, and this is not, I agree with it, but it's not something that I think is that big of a problem that it needs to be said. A lot of people have criticized that the villains in the game, that the side characters, are given absolutely no development, and it's completely true. The main problem is that there's just too stinking many of them. It's like they're trying to shove the entire gallery of Batman's villains into this one game. Within probably 15 minutes to an hour, 15 minutes to 20 minutes of gameplay, you've come across five of his villains in that time. So I can understand wanting to kind of get them all in there so that everybody who has their own little particular villain that they like can get that, you know, I know who that is type of feeling. But they did it better with Arkham Asylum, where you were finding clues that alluded to them as opposed to the actual characters themselves. Because of that, you know, nobody really gets their fair share in the spotlight. So you can't have the type of character development that I think a lot of people were looking for in story-wise. You just can't do it by putting as many people as they did. The developers need to really kind of bring the axe down on who they're going to include if they want to do character development, and basically turn it into like a story arc, you know, an actual comic book story arc where it focuses on no more than maybe three villains at a time. Anything more than that, and you're just going to end up getting flooded. Along with this, because I actually did pre-order it, I got the Catwoman downloadable. And I have to say, the segments playing as Catwoman, and there's only four of them, so it's not very much, but the times that you do get to play as her, mechanically, it's almost identical to playing as Batman. There are a few subtle differences, and the subtle differences are different enough that it really does make it worthwhile. Instead of swinging from grapple from building to building, she has her whip, so as she jumps off buildings, she whips the next building, which may not necessarily get her all the way to the top, but it'll get her at least on the side of the building, and then from there she can kind of Spider-Man wall crawl her way up. So, very, very fun with her to play. She has a couple really good story moments and very humorous ones as well. I would hesitate to call her the actual comedy relief, but if the shoe fits. So, I don't know if I'm going to necessarily purchase the other DLC that has been announced for this game, such as the Robin or the Nightwing pack. If I was the type of guy to purchase DLC, this probably would be the game that I would do it for. But I'm not really that kind of guy, so unfortunately I don't think that I will. But
Justin.
Yes.
The story arc of the original game, Arkham Asylum, was Joker's freed himself inside the asylum, let the prisoners free, and Batman has to go in and get there. What's the basic premise? What's the story behind Arkham City?
The story behind Arkham City is that Dr. Hugo Strange, who fans of Batman will know him as the psychiatrist that knows Batman's secret identity, Hugo Strange has convinced the former warden of Arkham Asylum, Quincy Sharp from the previous game, to wall off a section of the ghettos, basically, I think including maybe Crime Alley and a couple of those areas of Gotham, just walled off completely, and to move all of the inmates and prisoners from both Arkham Asylum and Blackgate Prison into this new, basically super secure city block, and lets them run wild. Well, Batman has his worries about this particular idea and is going in to investigate to find out what's really going on, because something about this just doesn't really smell right to him. And there was a short-run comic series for Arkham City, I believe that DC did, that explain. Well, yeah, it would have been DC, duh. That explains how this came to be, how Hugo came into power, why he's in charge of Arkham City, and how he convinced the city to allow him to do it in the first place. And all of that is explained. It also explains the immediate and inevitable rivalries that pop up between Penguin, Two-Face, Joker, and some of the other characters that are in Arkham City right now. The other big point to note is that Joker, at the end of Arkham Asylum, had taken the Titan formula, the beefed up version of Venom, turned into the big mutant monster, was defeated by Batman, but has now some very harsh, you know, continuing chronic side effects from that exposure. And health-wise, Joker is pretty much on the outs. He is on his deathbed. So there's something else going on inside Arkham where Joker is pulling the strings of these other villains to get them to kind of bicker among each other, and you don't really know why. That's as much as I can get into without necessarily spoiling anything. One quick news item to point out, I just found this out the other day. Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker, for those of you who know, and also the voice of the Joker, has decided that this will be his last performance as the Joker. He announced on his Twitter feed that this would be the last time he would be providing the voice for the Clown Prince of Crime. So, as sad as I am to hear that, it doesn't necessarily come as a surprise. A lot of people that were following the game knew that he was very, very reluctant to do Joker's voice in the game to begin with, and it wasn't until he heard that Kevin Conroy and a lot of the other people that had been big names in the previous series and that he had worked with before that were doing the game that he finally relented and came on. And now it just seems like he's kind of reached his run on it. He's had his fill, and he's going to go on, move on to do other things, to which we wish him the best, of course. It's unfortunate that he won't be providing that particular voiceover anymore. But I think Joe DiMaggio did a very, very good job in Under the Red Hood, so it's possible we might see him take over in the future. If so, maybe we'll get that same sort of grittier, deeper, darker Joker that he portrayed. And if we do, I think that's a good thing. I don't think many people had a lot of complaints with his performance in Under the Red Hood. Moving on from Arkham City, though, let's go ahead and transition over to Batman number 2, which came out this week. Jason, why don't you give us your quick take on this book?
I enjoyed this. This is Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, and they're discussing, and they're bringing you back through a Batman detective story. And that's one of the things that I really like with Batman is he is a detective in this story. And, you know, he's following the clues, following the leads. They do give an explanation for how they tie up the cliffhanger at the end of the previous episode, or the previous issue. And they start moving forward now. Whether that's a full tie-up or whether some of those strands are still loose, they just look tied up, we'll have to see. And one of the things that I really liked about this is Gotham City is a character in this. Yeah. Gotham has its own feel. They use the colorist did a wonderful job coloring this book to make the settings look and feel different. You get, you know, bright, you know, sun coming through and some, and, you know, dark. You know, the morgue has a greenish tint to it. Batman's cave has got a blue hue and is dark. But they also, you know, talk a lot about, you know, Gotham Tower, or Wayne Tower at the center of Gotham. And, you know, it really builds that Gotham is itself its own entity that Batman operates within. And, of course, Bruce believes that Gotham City is his city. He's there to protect it. He's the only guardian that it needs. And what they're showing us through the detective's work is that there may be a secret society called the Owls that's watching over Gotham. So is this really an ancient society from Gotham's past that's starting to show itself, or is this a new society that's claiming to be the old society? Yeah. Are they truly a hidden society, or are they, you know, something that actually still exists? So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing where this is going to head. Justin, what was your take on this?
I really enjoyed this book as well. I loved the idea of the 13th Guardian. If you read the book, you'll understand what I mean when you read it. The only thing that kind of irked me about this is Batman's rather stubborn and adamant denial of the existence of this Athenian society, the Owl Society, because, as you say, he does seem to be more detective-like in this book, even possibly more so than he is in Detective Comics, which is ironic. But for as detective-like as he's being, this sort of just absolute declaration of something, you know, which in this case is an absolute assumption because he has no evidential proof that we have seen yet to show that they don't exist. Whereas being a detective, you know, everything is suspect. Nothing is assumed. You have to follow everything. And it just seems really out of character, which granted it's a reboot. It's a new Batman. I understand the character isn't going to be the same as he was before, but this is out of character for a detective, any detective, period. So that kind of irked me a little bit, but overall, the book's fantastic. I didn't notice the thing about the colors that you mentioned. I'm going to have to go back and check that out again. But one thing I did notice in this book, having read other Scott Snyder works, is that his writing style affords itself very well to a particular panel or a page or a scene where you can almost hear the big music swell in the back of your head, where it's that setup, that build, and then there's a delivery and, like, a pose. And when they hit that pose, you can just hear the horns in the background with the big fanfare. Personally, I think that scene in here was when Batman is standing on the 13th Guardian. And, I mean, the stand-up looking down, is you can hear that moment like it was straight out of a movie. But I've seen that in his other books where it is that build-up to the big punch, and I love authors that can do that. There's so many out there that just either they can't or they won't or they don't, and I can't imagine why they wouldn't want to put that type of thing in there. So many artists just seem like they're not necessarily going through the motions, but the writing's just flat, and there's been a lot of titles coming out recently that have had that type of flat writing, which those are the ones that we put into our meh pile. So moving on to other DC books, Green Lantern Corps number 2 came out this week as well. I'm curious to see where this story is going. I think they have a good premise kind of under their belt so far. This book hasn't done a whole lot to separate itself out from its predecessor as far as being a whole new run on its own. I think it, just like the Green Lantern book, seems to be tied pretty strongly in with the books from before the reboot. The one thing that I am bummed about in this book, and it's funny that I mentioned it in Arkham City just a little bit ago, is that I feel, not really been any character development so far. I mean, it's only 2 issues in, so obviously you're not going to have, you know, the color purple in 2 issues, but I was hoping for a little bit of something here, you know, a little bigger nod towards Guy and John, and really this book focused more on everybody else. It's nice that they were in there throwing their punches and being their big bad GL selves, but, you know, give me a little meat here, guys. That's my take on it, though, which is obviously very opinionated, but Jason, what did you think?
I thought this book was very intriguing. Yeah, this book, actually, you're talking about character development. What they're really developing with this book is the villain, yeah, or villains, as the case may be, because they're establishing just how big and bad this enemy is, that they're able to decimate the corpse and when they're going after the core. You know, they're chopping off their fingers so that the rings are gone, but they're not capturing the rings. They're strong enough to defeat the Green Lantern, but they don't take the ring. So it really brings up an interesting question. Who are these people? What are they about? And when it hits the fan, you see the Green Lanterns fighting against them, and they're going, the willpower isn't stopping them. You know, they had to use all the willpower they could muster. What they normally were using when they're combating with the rings wasn't enough. They had to dig deep and pull from their guts, which, you know, you expect that from the heroes. So who is this enemy? Yeah, we haven't really seen them. I've got an idea of who I think it is based on the design of the costumes. I think I know where it's going to be, why they're as resistant as they are. It'll be interesting to see if I'm right. And so I'll keep you posted if my expectations are met. But I think the fact that they are as resistant to the willpower. I think we may be seeing the Alpha Lanterns coming back. The way that their masks are shaped, it definitely reminds me of Boudicca and some of the Alpha Lanterns. I was thinking maybe Manhunters, but I think the Alpha Lanterns are more likely. And, yeah, I think what you're hitting on your point about the character development for Guy and John and, you know, this being a relaunch, one of the things DC had said was they're making minimal changes to the Green Lantern franchise and the Batman franchise because those had been strong-selling books prior to the relaunch. They felt we were doing it well, why change it? So they only made the changes necessary to make it fit in with their new continuity. So the time frames have been compressed, you know, as to how long it's been since they first appeared on the scene versus when the War of Light or the, you know, Black Lanterns appeared. That's all been compressed as a time period. So instead of 70 years of comics worth, you know, it's now for Green Lantern, it's only taken, you know, 3 to 5 years for those all events to all happen. But the characters are still the same. That's why I don't think you're seeing as much development. You know, Guy is still a prick, and John is still, you know, trying to hold the weight of the world on his shoulders and support everything and, you know, be the pillar beneath everything, hold everything up. And, of course, he feels the weight of the two worlds he's destroyed on his shoulders. And he actually kind of get a hint at that, you know, in one of his lines of dialogue in this book. So overall, I think it's a good continuation of the run. I really want to see if this is the Manhunters or the Alpha Lanterns or not as the villains. I think it'll make a very interesting arc if it is. It explains why they're so personal to the Green Lanterns. Yeah. But speaking of groups and, you know, their new origins, we both read Justice League number 2. Jeff Johns and Jim Lee put that out for us. And for me, this is where the first book should have ended. The first issue should have been a double issue. It should have ended here because there wasn't enough in that first issue. It wasn't that it left you wanting more. It's that it didn't build up high enough. I think this is where you really needed to leave it for that, you know, build up to have happened for you to go, okay, now there's something I want to see more of. I'm not entirely thrilled with how they're depicting the Justice League coming together. Green Lantern and Flash knew each other, but none of the other heroes who they obviously knew about, but they'd never met before. Yeah, this certainly takes away from the story of Superman and Batman meeting, and, you know, when Bruce comes to, you know, Metropolis, or Superman goes to Gotham. You know, and, you know, Bruce saying, if you attack me, some innocent will blow up. And Superman goes, you're not lying. He goes, of course not. But the bomb is on Bruce Wayne. Yeah. So he, you know, wasn't lying. There was a bomb on somebody he considered an innocent himself. But, yeah, he would have only harmed himself, not anybody else. So, yeah, that whole dark and light of Superman, Batman was a great meeting story. That was one of their previous stories for how they met. And, you know, there's probably other tellings of that story, of that or different stories of how they meet. This is just, how can we make everybody come together? And the one thing that I think this is really doing is downplaying the villain, which, you know, they've revealed it's that the strange boxes are mother boxes, that it was a parademon Batman was chasing at the beginning of the first book if you didn't recognize him. So what this does is we've got all these heroes coming together, but we don't really have a villain that's denoting it's powerful enough to need all these heroes. And maybe throughout the arc, they'll be able to fully develop it. But if they had a villain that showed up and started beating one of their asses, you know, took out Green Lantern or took out Flash, and then, you know, Batman shows up and gets taken out, and they decide, now we need to start calling in everybody and get everybody together, you know, whether we like them or not, you know, then all of a sudden you've got a villain that justifies having this whole team put together. And they've announced they're going to be having Wonder Woman, and they put together some secret files on, you know, Wonder Woman and her kind of origin. If you're not reading her story, it's at the back of the book. It's not really part of the story arc. It's just some extra filler material. And we'll be seeing Wonder Woman in the next issue. And, of course, you know, this issue does reveal how, yeah, Cyborg becomes the Cyborg, and makes you wonder, well, if this is how he becomes Cyborg, what happened to his time with the Teen Titans? Or where does that fit in, since he's looks like he's going to come straight into joining the team? Justin, what were your takes on this book?
Pretty much the same as yours. I really enjoyed it. I'm not going to say I don't agree with how they come together, because I can appreciate the whole idea of being lumped together by circumstance, and it really does make sense that if an enemy is powerful enough that it gets all of their attentions, that they would just naturally sort of congregate together on it, because if they in fact have never met each other before, they know of each other but never met, then they have no reason to believe that any of the others would be capable, that anybody else would be capable of handling an issue of this magnitude other than themselves. So it makes sense to me in so far as that. I love the interaction between Green Lantern and Flash. The two of them, you can see the kind of budding friendship between the two already, but their dialogue, it was fantastic, and I loved how they played off each other. Similarly, I found interesting the interaction between Superman and Batman, whereas the, you know, GL and Flash had an almost sort of jovial bickering, Superman and Batman were all business, and they were all about what was going on, why was it going on, what was it doing, and you could almost feel that instant mutual respect for each other. So I think that will develop well. I am curious to see how they're going to bring Wonder Woman in on this, because she hasn't even been mentioned in passing. I haven't been reading her book, so I don't know necessarily how much what her story is as far as what they may have changed. I did read the dossier in the back of this issue and found it very interesting. It's an interview between Amanda Waller and Steve Trevor, I believe is his name. Is that correct?
Yeah, Steve Trevor.
Yeah, yeah. The pilot that crashes on Themyscira and is part of the reason why Wonder Woman comes to or leaves Themyscira in the first place. I did find that interesting, so I am curious to see how she comes in. I'm also curious to see how Aquaman is going to get pulled into this, because from reading his number one a couple weeks ago, I am really psyched for his character, and I want to see how he can really bring it to the table with these guys. So it's continuing to be interesting. It's still a good book. The guys at the shop mentioned, and I believe it to be true, and you said it as well, these books leave something to be desired. They leave you lacking. Not because you want more because it's that good, but because you want more because there wasn't enough there. So I agree with that.
That's a bad thing.
It is. It really, really is. Because a book of this caliber and a flagship title, with no bones about it, should be their, I mean, to continue the food metaphor as much as I don't really want to, it needs to be a filling meal. There's got to be enough there that you can have that and possibly only that and be good, and, you know, and be fulfilled, and it's just not there. It's just, it's all bread or rice.
Yeah, I mean, DC is charging $3.99 for Justice League instead of the $2.99 that they've drawn the line at. And I think they'll be dropping it down. I don't know at which point they'll eventually drop it back down. But for $3.99, especially with the relaunch, I think it would have been great for them to show the fans that they're really out there for the fans to have done this. Both, you know, if they'd have done one and two as a single issue, put that out as issue number one for $3.99. And I think that would have been a much more filling meal for, you know, especially with that higher price. Yeah. It's nice to have that little interview section with Trevor and Waller at the end of the book, but I really don't want to pay that extra dollar for it. There was the character designs that they put in at the end of the book, nice, but I don't want to pay that extra dollar for it. You know, if they put out two issues of the book, you know, and I didn't have to pay the extra dollar for the version that didn't have it, I wouldn't have done it. I would have kind of stuck because I want to get the book, so I have to pay that extra dollar. I'm waiting for them to go back to their line that they drew at $2.99 with this book. I think they will. They just wanted to include some extra stuff. They thought they were giving us some extra stuff that we would really want. I don't think they quite gave us what we really, really want from it, though.
Well, what we wanted, give us extra pages, actual pages of comic. Don't give us filler stuff. Save that for the trade hardback. You're going to put it in there anyways. Fine, you have it. We'll find it in there when we go and pay, you know, the $14 or whatever for that. Give us more comic. If we're going to pay more for it, give us more of what we actually want.
Absolutely.
Moving on, let's talk about Red Hood and the Outlaws, number two, that came up this week. I know you did not particularly like the first issue that came out. I liked it a bit more than you did. How did you feel number two measured up?
This was better. It still wasn't good. It was better though. And Scott Lobdell finally defines Starfire's personality. She's Paris Hilton. So, yeah. And, yeah, we realize that when she pulls up in the limo, she's dressed as a fashionista, and she still just wants to sleep with everybody. So, yeah. Jason's story also got better this week, but I felt it was weak. Yeah. And it didn't bring anything special or new to him. Yeah, they brought him to this, you know, society where, you know, after he's resurrected and Talia dips him into the Lazarus pit, he comes back, and in order to make him into a better person, Talia brings him to this mountain, secret mountaintop retreat where the monks live. And the monk, of course, despite being 1,000 years old, is able to kick his ass with one hand and, you know, is there to teach him how to be a better person. It's rather derivative. I wish I could say I did like that character. But, you know, for me, there was nothing great. You know, there was nothing original about this telling. Dead Man went and lived with monks on a big mountain. Batman did it in his previous life. You know, so, you know, there wasn't anything unique. I mean, Luke went and met Yoda, the old wrinkled guy in the swamp that was able to kick his ass with one hand. Yeah, at least...
No hands.
You know, and... You know, for a book that's The Red Hood and the Outlaws, it gives a little bit of a backstory, an explanation for, you know, why they're going to this place. And I think Lobdell uses that to try and make Jason a tragic character by having all the monks there killed and the old lady, something is bad enough to have killed that old lady. And then, of course, the corpses become reanimated and attack the group, so Jason now has to kill the dead corpses of his friends. And you know, he's been such a hard ass and kind of emotionless, doesn't care about anybody, you know, both in the relaunch and what we've kind of seen of him in this relaunch. You know, he was that way before the relaunch as well. Yeah. So to believe that there were people on this mountain that he cared about, you know, I still don't buy it. I don't buy Jason being a tragic character that bad things have happened to. Yeah. Yes, he was a street urchin. Yes, he was taken in by Batman, who he, you know, proceeded to, you know, disrespect and not care for, which got him killed. And now he's back to life. He was originally just a corpse with no soul, popped in a Lazarus pit. And now he's back, you know, and brought to this mountain. And these people became his friends and taught him how to be a good person. And now he's not a good person again. I don't care about these characters, and, you know, I'm sorry, I just don't like the way this book is going. Justin, maybe you can find some redeeming qualities.
Well, let me start off by saying that I really think it's that lack of emotion that is going to end up being the key to Jason Todd's character. It's because he has this... you know, a wall built up where he is the tacit, the brooding, you know, kind of like Bruce. But that emotionless shell, it's not that he's emotionless. I think it's that if he lets his emotions get the better of him, he will become that the villain Red Hood that we have seen in the past, where he is driven by his rage, where he's driven by his sorrow, and leads him down to this dark place that I think he doesn't really want to be anymore. So instead, he completely just shuts them all off. It'll be when the cracks start to show in this wall and in this character that that is when he will start to become something that you can relate to, you know, somebody that is going to actually be a human being. Until that happens, we still have Roy's character, who's just the sort of bombastic moron, which I'm kind of enjoying. I think it's funny. He's the only one in this trio that actually shows any regular relative emotion as far as the others are concerned. I mean, he's the only one that's actually acting like a human being. He's acting like a prick, but he's acting like a human being. Whereas Todd is, you know, this iceberg and Starfire is vapid. Roy is the only one that actually has anything that you can relate to. And he's just a dumbass. So, as far as that's concerned, I am, at least with this issue, I think beginning to feel out the dynamic between these characters. And as much as I know you say you don't really care for it, I kind of am. I'm starting to enjoy this idea of a group that, not that they necessarily don't like each other, but they don't know how to like each other. Like, they actually have just this baggage that literally prevents them from creating any type of emotional connection to anybody else, and the fact that they're, I think, slowly going to work through it. So, I'm going to continue getting it. Whether we'll both continue to read it, it remains to be seen. Probably not, would be my guess, but I think it has much more room to grow than it has so far, which I think you could probably agree with as well, but it certainly hasn't gotten there yet.
It definitely needs to grow.
Well, a couple other DC books that I was looking at this week, I picked up DC Universe Presents Dead Man number 2, and I picked up Blue Beetle number 2. Dead Man number 2, I really, really liked. I enjoyed the book because it's very existential. It's very meta, and I just love those kinds of stories. And those kinds of stories are good, but they have to be well done. If you have something like this that's written only kind of okay, it'll be horrible. And these have been written really, really good, very, very well. It's compelling. It's sympathetic. There's exciting action. It's got werewolves. It's got vampires. It's got all kinds of fun stuff. So it's a book worth picking up and checking out. It's only going to be a short run because, if I remember correctly, DCU Presents is going to showcase one character at a time, and it will continue to switch on new characters. I think they're doing runs of 4. I'm not positive about that. I'd have to look into it. But I think every 4 issues, maybe 6 issues, they're then going to switch and go to a new character. Blue Beetle number 2, I'm still going to keep picking it up. It's still kind of enjoyable, but this one felt like a kind of a coaster of a story. Just continue along. It's, you know, okay, well, here's the rest of the story so far, and yay. That's about all I can say for it. It was very, very meh. Entertaining point, he tries to tell somebody what's going on, and the Scarab is fighting so hard to prevent him from doing that, that it actually makes him puke on a lady's shoes. I find that funny. I, you know, call me a sick whatever. I thought it was funny.
Now, if DC does actually carry through with their, you know, 4 issue arcs and then a new character in the DCU Presents, yeah, that could make that an interesting series to follow, because even if you don't particularly care for the character they're featuring, there's going to be a new one soon. So it might be worth just picking up just so you can experience a lot of the B-list characters, or, you know, characters that don't get their own titles, you know, or, you know, and, you know, if you pick it up and you're following a character that you really like, if it does well, they'll give it its own title. And that, I think that's one of the ways you get to experiment and put out new characters to see if there's a following enough for a new title.
Definitely. And I want to say, I think the next one that DCU Presents is going to follow is Captain Marvel. I can't say that 100% positive, but I think that's what they've said. And they've dropped hints to that actually in the dossier at the end of JLA. So
yes, that's
my prediction. That's where they're going to go next.
Yes.
Moving on, though, Jason, you had another indie title, actually, that you picked up this week that was from one of the lesser-known indie shops, right?
Well, this is Bongo Comics, which Bongo is probably best known for the Simpsons comics. Yeah, they do all the Simpsons, Nuclear Man and Fallout Boy, which, of course, are the superhero from the Simpsons universe. And Yeah. I've been talking about the Sergio Argnos funnies for the past three issues. Issue number four just came out. It's more of the same. Yeah, it's Sergio's traditional mime, one-page mime cartoons, where it's just a one-page, each page has got its own little story that plays out with no words in it. Yeah, all great for a good chuckle. And then he also has been using this to be autobiographical. He tells an autobiographical story about himself. And he actually had a theme running through this book about puppets because he loves puppets. So he talks about his experience when he first had them, putting on his own puppet show as a child, and then, going out and exploring and finding new places to find puppets and museums where they have puppets, and even putting on a puppet show for kids at the museum. Now, the other thing that he does is he tells another story, which is where the writer got the idea for this story, Pinocchio. The actual true story of the puppet that came to life that the book and later the Disney movie are based off of. So that's a fun read because apparently it was a practical joke. Geppetto was an actual person who carved himself a wooden boy, and some of the townspeople, because they thought it would be funny, stole the toy and replaced it with an orphan that was dressed in the same clothes. And he, believing that his prayers had been answered, believed that boy to actually be the puppet that he carved, and decided to carve himself a wife. And, of course, they decide they have to continue the joke, and they hire a prostitute or a barmaid from the town to fill in for the carved wife that Geppetto carved for himself. So, now, of course, the author of Pinocchio put the story in a bar. What?
It's a Renaissance Italy adoption program.
Yes. Well, the joke was on all the friends because apparently the guy was very happy with his new wife and child. So while they were laughing at him, he had a wonderful time. So yeah, I enjoyed the book. It's Sergio doing more of what Sergio does best. And I'll be continuing to wait for more books from him. So, now, Justin, you read a Marvel book. So, mm-hmm.
This week was the finale of Fear Itself, the big crossover event that's been going on at Marvel for the past 7 months. Actually, maybe a little bit more than that. It ends well. That's what I'm going to say. Fear Itself ends with a big, big bang. It went out with all the pomp and gusto that you would expect. There's a whole lot of epilogue to this book, though. It feels very thick, and it feels very heavy when you pick it up. That's because probably a little less than half of it is all lead-in for the next series of stuff that they're going to do, which I'm not going to read.
So it was good, it just wasn't good enough.
Yeah, it really was. I enjoyed this. I'd been trying to kind of dip my toe back into the Marvel Universe to try to get myself back into it, find something that I'd like. I have enjoyed this book. There's no doubt about it. But I feel like trying to read this standalone and not reading the other involved books as part of the Fear Itself event made it so that these seven issues were not strong enough to stand on their own. There wasn't enough to this and only this that
it was a poor time.
I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. It's just, very, very similar to JLA, because this was their big event, because this was what kind of everything else was being revolved around at this time, there should have been more to it. And I feel like not that it wasn't there. It had the big moments. It had the big builds. It had the big story points. What it didn't have was cohesion. It was like a scene from this book, a scene from that book, a scene from this one, and you know that they're all there. You know that they're all other titles that are part of this event, but all you're getting is a glimpse, and you know that there's more to it, and you just aren't getting the full picture, and it would be so much more if you did. So, moving on.
It was
from
a way to
that,
sell the side books for this story, is what it was.
It really was. And it's so sad that that's what it was.
Yeah.
But
and then Ghost Rider appears in Storm. To find out what happened with Ghost Rider, go read the Ghost Rider Fear Itself tie-in. Oh, and look, here comes Wolverine. Go read the Wolverine Fear Itself tie-in to find out what he's doing.
Just give me the story. That's all I want. Exactly. Just give me the story. I don't want to read the other stuff. But on that somewhat depressing note, that is all of the or almost all the books from this week. So let's go ahead. I believe you said we actually got some feedback email this week, didn't we?
Yeah, we actually did. We got Robert writing in, and Robert had a couple of questions for us. The first one is, does Sinestro now have a green ring? How do they patch up the breach between Sinestro and the Green Lantern Corps? And, of course, this is directly related to what's going on in the current Green Lantern book. Now, at the end, right before the relaunch, at the end of the Green Lantern book, is when Sinestro actually gains a Green Lantern ring. It's at the end of the Green Lantern War. And we're still trying to figure out why he has this ring. Because, you know, as far as all the Green Lanterns know, he's still this villain that they want to kill. And, you know, he's destroyed entire civilizations. What has he done that he deserves a second chance? Why does he get this second ring, this ring again? You know, the Corps, you know, at one point actually goes to strip it off of him. And the Guardians actually protect him because they're not sure why he has it. The Guardians themselves don't know why Sinestro has a green ring now. So the whole story of redemption for Sinestro is what's playing out currently in the Green Lantern arc. So if and actually the Yellow Lanterns, which were the Sinestro Corps, are actually after Sinestro now because they're wondering why he has a ring. They want to know, what is he going to do with this ring? Is he now going to come after them? And you know, the end of the second issue of Green Lantern, Sinestro has finally kind of identified the core, the Yellow Lantern Corps isn't doing what I created them to do. They're not using their fear to create a better world for people. They're using it to create a worse world for people. And now I need to go take the Green Lantern ring that I have and stop them. So that kind of leads to the idea that maybe it's a chance of redemption to stop his own core. So we'll have to see where that goes because, you know, the whole reason why he has it is up in the air. Justin, you have anything to add on that?
No, that sums up and answers the question pretty well. I don't think there's really much I can add to that. The next question was, does Bruce Wayne know who Damian's mother is or of his past with Raj? To my understanding, yes, Bruce Wayne does know that Damian is the son of Talia al Ghul, and he knows that Damian has been trained by Raj in the League of Assassins, and I would dare say, luckily it was Dick Grayson that had to do most of the heavy lifting as far as getting Damian under control and getting those assassin tendencies kind of out of his blood. But it will be interesting to see how well he's going to mesh with Bruce in the coming Batman and Robin books. I know that's something that you had said you were very excited to see, and I do think that it's going to be a very interesting story point coming from there. Why don't you go ahead and take the next question here, Jason?
Just a real quick follow-up. If you are interested in the story of Batman and Talia getting together, Batman, Son of the Demon, which is a trade paperback by Barr and Bingham, is the actual story where Talia gets pregnant and how she convinces Bruce to leave her with the child, who he actually believes has been miscarried. So, when he does turn up, Talia actually does, have to apologize for making him believe that, and she does admit that, she fooled him. So, if you are interested in that story, Batman: Son of the Demon trade paperback, check your comic shop or local bookstore. And finally, Robert had asked, "Do members of the Suicide Squad die regularly, or at least in the old version?"
Yeah.
And was Mako a villain from Savage Dragon from Image Comics? As to Mako being a villain, I didn't read Savage Dragon, so I don't know all the villains, but with a little bit of research I did, I couldn't find any reference to a villain called Mako. Being the Savage Dragon, there is a possibility that there was a shark-like villain, and there may have been, but I couldn't find anything.
I would dare say probably a very large possibility that there was a villain called Mako in Savage Dragon. I'm looking through his rogues gallery. There are some pretty freaky, weird characters in that book, so it is extremely likely. However, I think the character that you're referring to from Suicide Squad is actually called Hammerhead. Different kind of shark, same type of idea. He's a shark guy. Pretty straightforward.
And actually, now, I think he's King Shark. The type of shark King is Hammerhead. Yes. He is King Shark, though.
I'm sorry, you are correct. as far as the members dying regularly, I didn't read previous versions of Suicide Squad. Jason, did you?
I read a mini-series with them, and everybody survived. Now, if that was typical, I couldn't say. The problem with writing a book called Suicide Squad is you get characters that become fan favorites that develop in the book, which makes them hard to kill. Or you bring in and you have lead characters, somebody like Deadpool, you know, and a solid, you know, second, like Harley.
Deadshot, you mean?
Deadshot. Yeah, and Deadshot and Harley are so established in the DC universe that they're fan favorites, you can't kill them. Yeah. Or you have to have some way of, quote-unquote, bringing them back, which hopefully DC is going to look at not doing as much of in their new universe. But having characters that people know makes it really hard to kill them. So then you bring in a bunch of side characters, and what you wind up with is the red shirt syndrome from Star Trek. Okay, we've got Kirk, we got Spock, we got McCoy, we've got a strange guy in a red shirt. Which one's going to die? Now, they may be able to alleviate some of that by rotating in certain people and having them appear and disappear throughout the squad. So you may see somebody is not on the next mission, then he comes back for a third mission, and that's where he dies. Or you know, somebody they rotate different characters in and out. So you may not necessarily see them every week, so that they become secondary characters and you can then kind of play with them and kill them. Or you rotate somebody like Deadpool out and you bring in somebody else as the commander and you kill that person. But again, it makes it very hard to write a book like Suicide Squad and you know, surprise people by killing people off when all the known characters are probably not going to get harmed in any way. So we'll have to see. I know in the miniseries I read, I don't think anybody died. So, but maybe we'll actually get a break from the standard formula of red shirts in this. Might be kind of interesting if they do decide to kill off Deadpool, and they could always bring him back as a new person wearing
Deadpool.
The armor.
You keep calling him Deadpool.
Deadshot. Maybe they need to kill him off because I keep confusing him.
No kidding. Well, not to mention, Deadpool is so inundated in the Marvel Universe now, and just in comic books in general. I mean, you can't walk 10 feet without tripping over a Deadpool title in some way, shape, or form. So, believe me, it's completely understandable. Sadly,
I think some of the fun with this title will come with Deadshot trying to rebel, trying to gain his freedom. How can he remove the explosive in his neck? How can he, you know, get time to be with his daughter? So, you know, by taking some of those facets, I think you can start to build a more interesting dynamic than just him being a hired gun. How can he get out of this job and out to being back to the freelance assassin that he was? You know, Harley might start wanting to escape because Joker's free and she wants to go be with her lovey. So I think they've definitely got some roads they can go down, even if they do have to follow the red shirt syndrome for a while.
So. Well, do that just to get people hooked and then you know change the formula after the fact. But we'll see. Getting back to the question, unfortunately the answer is we're not really sure. So, by all means, go find some old copies of Suicide Squad at your friendly local comic shop and see if you can let us know, because if you find out, write in. Tell us.
Absolutely. And speaking right of, in, you're going to need a place. So
that is true. I was going to say, speaking of writing in, you can contact us by you can find us at thecomicbooknerd.com. The Comic Book Tesseract is in the sidebar there, and all of our old shows are there as well if you want to catch up on this particular netcast. You can also find us at Twitter. I am at Felix T. Cat. That's a cat with a K and two T's. And Jason is at J. Polyev. You can send us an email at comicbooktesseract@gmail.com. Or if you prefer, you can leave a voicemail or a text message at 50Tesseract. That's 508-377-3722. Well, I think that's it for this week. I know there's a couple books that are a little bit older that we'll probably look at talking about next week. There's one that we both read called Persepolis that is a very well-known graphic novel. We can talk about that next week. Also, I think we'll probably end up talking about Return of the Dapper Men, another well-acclaimed and well-reviewed book. So tune in next week to hear what we have to say about it. Anyways, I am Justin Chalupa, and for Jason Polyev, allow me to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week. Thanks.